From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with Senator Ted Kennedy. His new book, America Back on Track, argues for a change in the direction of America's policy. He says our leaders in the Congress, the White House, and the judiciary have let Americans down. We'll talk about what he thinks should be done, why Democrats have trouble winning elections, and how the Senate has changed since he first ran for office 44 years ago. And he'll tell us about growing up as a Kennedy. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book of essays about Allen Ginsberg's famous poem, Howl, which is 50 years old now. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest, Ted Kennedy, has represented Massachusetts in the United States Senate for more than 43 years. He was elected to his brother John Kennedy's seat in 1962, when he was barely old enough to hold the office. Now, at age 74, Kennedy remains a power in the Senate, negotiating recently with the White House and Senator John McCain on immigration reform. He's still a staunch advocate of liberal causes and recently supported Massachusetts Republican Governor Mitt Romney's program to expand health care for that state's uninsured. Kennedy is running for re-election next year, and he's written a new book outlining his policy priorities. It's called America Back on Track. Senator Kennedy, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book deals with a whole lot of areas, from health care to tax policy to labor relations. And I think, you know, if your book were the platform of a political candidate, you mentioned you will be running for re-election, your opponent would probably go through here and add up the cost of all of the additional initiatives. And there are many: increasing unemployment compensation, increasing spending on early childhood education, college funding, federal job training. Someone would look at this and say this is an unrealistic, classic liberal tax and spend, throw money at the problem approach to government. Can America afford it?
Well, let's take some of these issues. When we put into place the Cold War GI Bill to pay for the education of all the veterans that returned from World War II, the Treasury's analysis of that showed that the Treasury received $7 for every dollar it invested in education, because these individuals had a considerable success in terms of their life career. Sil Conti, who was a Republican congressman from Massachusetts, and Tip O'Neill were the great advocates of that program. And, of course, it paid for itself many, many, many times over. Take, for example, health care. For every dollar that we are spending in health care now, 33 cents of that is non-clinical. That's administrative costs that are paying it now. No business could survive that. We are supporting the information technology. Information technology, the IT, bringing electronics into the paying of bills and the administrative costs. The Institutes of Medicine, the Academy of Sciences, said if you brought in information technology into the current healthcare system, you'd save between $150 and $175 billion a year. Do you hear me? $150 to $175 billion a year, more than enough to afford to have a national health insurance policy. Secondly, we do very poorly in the area of preventive healthcare. One out of every $4 that we spend in Medicare is on diabetes. One out of every $10 we spend on health care is on diabetes. There is a great deal that can be done in terms of the prevention in terms of diabetes that we don't do, that can save billions and billions of dollars. My point being is, if you have in your program a very robust preventive health care program, if you're using the best in terms of information technology, we're already spending the amount of resources, overly spending so, and they can be used and used effectively within a Medicare system to afford to pay for health care. Including in that was going to be mental health. You know, the fact is, if we do this in the right way, if we take into consideration prevention, if we bring into the right technologies, if we deal with the health care in the comprehensive way, we can bring the health care. If we have more competition in terms of the prescription drugs, we can bring the health care costs down, and we can pass a program. We are spending everything that needs to be spent in healthcare. It's just being spent in the wrong way.
Well, you know, Senator, if Republican policies have, as you argue in this book, weakened the economy and harmed the interests of so many working Americans, really a majority of Americans, as you would argue, a lot of people wonder, why can't Democrats win more elections?
Well, I believe we're going to win a great deal of more, certainly in the future. I think what we have seen in the very recent past is sort of a culture of fear that has permeated the political dialogue. I think after 9/11, certainly the Republicans wrapped their political rhetoric and their political campaigning around this culture of fear and the dangers of terrorism. I think Americans are naturally very much concerned about national security and about terrorism. And I think that that fear was basically exploited, I think, in a very negative way, and I think basically a harmful way in terms of our country. When we looked at other national crises and other national leaders, President Kennedy in the Cuban Missile Crisis, where we almost had nuclear confrontation, or Lincoln during the Civil War, or Franklin Roosevelt, when we really were facing enormously challenging times in terms of the existence of our nation, our political leaders at that time did not dwell on this politics of fear. I think Americans have responded to it, I think, and it's been an unfortunate, but I don't think they're prepared to accept it. Certainly in 2006, I think the Democrats are going to have important victories in the House and Senate.
We're speaking with Senator Ted Kennedy. His new book is called America Back on Track. It's certainly easy enough to make the case, as you do in this book and others have, that Americans were misled on the reasons for going to war in Iraq, and that a lot of big mistakes have been made, and that it is not going well. But it's difficult. I mean, your fellow senator from Massachusetts, John Kerry, in his presidential campaign found it, I think, difficult to convince that there was a coherent alternative here. Now that the war is, in fact, with us, it is very difficult when American service men and women are engaged in Iraq to know exactly what do we do. Congressman Murtha said we should withdraw to limited areas. Is there a plan that you can present to the American people among Democrats on what to do now?
Well, first of all, the best vote I've ever cast in the United States Senate was against going to war, and it was really based on the testimony that we received on the Armed Services Committee, where Wes Clark, General Hoare, General Nash, many who had been the leaders in the first Gulf War and also had been the central commanders in Europe and had been experienced warriors from Vietnam, all recommended against going to war for reasons that are all too familiar now. It was the military that advised against. It was civilians that wanted to go. That was a great, of course, mistake. At the present time, I think that the statements that have been made by General Abizade last February, General Casey last summer, that have been made by Secretary Laird in his article in Foreign Affairs, that the large presence of the United States military forces are inflaming the insurgency and have become a crutch for the different factions in Iraq, for their unwillingness to develop a national consensus in the national government, which is essential if it's going to be able to develop the kind of security in terms of its military as well as in police to make the legitimate decisions to govern a nation. And that's why I believe we ought to have substantial reductions of Americans this year. We ought to be doing that at the present time. I think if that was the clear direction that the United States was going in, I think you would find a changed atmosphere and a climate in Iraq where the warring factions would recognize that they better get about the business of making a deal before it was too late. Clearly, that's a part of the solution. The second part has to be in trying to bring some reconciliation among the countries in that region to recognize they have a responsibility to be of help and assistance in that area. And I think we have to do what can be done in terms of the reconstruction. But we have to be dead serious about this. This is the transition year, 2006. This is going to be the year where our policy is going to shift and our policy is going to change, and we need a substantial and continuing reduction of American troops.
My guest is Senator Ted Kennedy. He has a new book called America Back on Track. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with Senator Ted Kennedy. He has a new book. It's called America Back on Track. You know, Senator, few people have had the same job for 43 years. You won election to the United States Senate in 1962, not long after Lyndon Johnson was majority leader. I mean, you have a long tenure in this body. How has it changed?
Well, it's the most dramatic shift and change has been the force of and the presence of money and the need and necessity for candidates to go out and raise a lot of money and therefore draw them away from doing what they should be doing, and that is attending to the United States Senate. When I first arrived there, that was a 12-month job. We got used to get the 4th of July and Labor Day, and we got Christmas. I was in the mid-1960s. We were in between Christmas and New Year's voting. At that time, it was voting on the war in Vietnam. We used to get back, leave late Friday afternoon, and get back Sunday nights and be ready to go. Now, candidates and the Senate, for all intents and purposes, doesn't get going till Tuesday noon, and most of the senators are gone Thursday night back to raise resources for their campaigns. And it's we are, I think, a lesser institution and failing to really deal with the what we should be dealing with, and that's the people's business. I think there's a way of dealing with it. I'm a strong believer in public financing of campaigns. We, in 1973, I had legislation with Hugh Scott, who was the Republican leader, to provide public financing of House and Senate and presidential campaigns. And we actually won it in the Senate, but we couldn't get the House of Representatives to go along with it. They've done some in the presidential campaigns, but it's in disfavor today. But that seems to me to be the way that we eventually have to go, because we are failing in our responsibilities, I think, to the American people institutionally.
You know, Joe Klein referred to you in his new book as ground zero for the party's liberal establishment. And I think there's an image of you among some as a sort of a predictable voice of the Democratic left, willing to make an inspired speech without really getting anything done. But, you know, to serious students of the Capitol, I think in some respects quite the opposite is true. I mean, you, those who know the Senate well know that you've really immersed yourself in the details, the nitty-gritty of legislation, and really learned to master the procedures and personal relationships of the Senate, and have a long list of accomplishments, not just bills passed, but also conservative initiatives thwarted, I mean, including the Republican Contract for America in the mid-90s when the Democrats were in the minority in the Senate. And I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about your education in the ways of the Senate. I mean, was there a time in your career when you felt you understood how this place works? Was there a mentor that helped you get there?
Well, I think the model was, and the standard really was is set by President Kennedy and Leverett Saltonstall. They didn't team up very often. My brother was elected to the Senate in '52. Senator Saltonstall was in there, but I noticed that they teamed up on a number of different issues. A lot of them related to particular regional issues, but I noticed that my brother and Senator Saltonstall developed a New England group of Republicans and Democrats to try and find ways of working together. I sort of grew up in that tradition about trying to get things done. I always thought that that is one of the principal reasons you're in the United States Senate, is to get things done. And that's the way I've tried to work in the United States Senate, and we have had some success. I mean, we're continuing to work now with Senator McCain on the issues of immigration and immigration reform. Right after that, we're going to work with Senator Specter on the voting rights extension, which is so important, has to be reauthorized again. We've worked with a number of different senators over the period of time. I worked with Orrin Hatch on the Ryan White legislation that dealt with AIDS, about the CHIP program that was the Children's Health Insurance Program. He was interested in children and children's issues. So we've tried to do that, and we've had some success.
I was struck by your relationships with Orrin Hatch and Alan Simpson, who were, you know, ideologically almost polar opposites of yours, maybe. But and one of the things that's interesting to me about that is that in modern Washington, it seems to me that whenever you have a conversation with someone, there's always a subtext, and you must always be thinking, well, what's really their agenda? What are they trying to manipulate me into, or how are they trying to game me? And I wonder if it's hard to develop relationships of trust in modern Washington. It seems that you have with some of these senators.
Well, we joke both with Senator Simpson and Orrin Hatch. We used to say if we co-sponsored each other's legislation, usually one of us hasn't read it. You know, that was, but, you know, I'd find, for example, I'd be fighting with Orrin Hatch on the floor of the Senate on fetal transplantation. That was a issue with regards to basic research and NIH funding, and I'd be fighting with him in the morning, and then I'd be going down in the afternoon working with him on the Religious Restoration Act, which we eventually got passed, about state and federal impediments on terms of religious practices. For example, the state may have a rule that no children can have wine or drink wine under 16, and yet it is part of the Catholic tradition in its mass, permits them to take the wine. Well, you know, there are a number of actions that similar to this in the different religions, and Orrin and I hooked up on a way to try and to protect religious rights and protect religious liberty. So, you know, even though you differ on one time, you try and find ways of working at another. And I think unless you have that kind of a temperament, if you're going to just get upset with somebody that's just going to oppose you, you're in the wrong business, because you've got to get into another business. But you have to look at this and try and figure, well, I'll try and get that person on another bill at another time.
Aside from personal relationships, there are the procedures of the Senate, and I've read that, you know, that the legendary Richard Russell of Georgia, you know, had mastered all these arcana. And I wonder, has that changed? Do you have to know a million procedural rules? And I'm wondering whether the way the Senate operates has changed in recent years. There's been a lot of talk that the House of Representatives now has, you know, is more regimented, and that committee hearings aren't meaningful. Have the rules of the Senate changed in ways that really matter?
Well, I think that's a very keen observation. I mean, I think that there's no question, but they have. I mean, it's the the amount of time that you would be willing to give to a particular legislation, rather than using cloture to close down the debate on a particular issue. It's slapped down very quickly now. You can remember even the last weeks when Bill Frist introduced his very punitive immigration legislation and then put a cloture on it before it even had a half an hour's debate on it. And then eventually he drew back on that, so, because he knew he probably wouldn't have gotten the cloture vote. But it's used as sort of a threatening technique. But what has been most dangerous is the fact that when you have conferences, that the minority isn't even included in the conference. You always, for years, there you have the conference and you work it out as you would a general kind of debate and discussion. And
now, just to clarify for the audience, we're talking about a situation where
that is a bill that passes the House, and then you have a bill that passes the Senate, and then it goes to what they call a conference between the two to try and iron out the difference. Now it will just be the Republicans will only invite the Republicans, and they'll work out the differences and just serve up the conference report and not even bother with getting signatures from Democratic senators on there and jam that thing through. They have the votes clearly in the House and more often than not in the Senate. And the bills always look a great deal more like the House passed bill than the Senate passed bill.
And that did not happen when Democrats controlled the Senate?
No. It was, and this is rather technical, but it's a very interesting process. When Al Simpson and I were, for example, on the immigration bill, he wouldn't let the bill go past the Senate. Until the conference was worked out. That means we would finish with all of the amendments, and what they have is the third reading, and then under normal procedures, you pass the bill, right? The leader, who was a Democrat at this time, would just stop. They'd have the third reading, which means you can't amend it any further. And then he'd go to a different subject matter, and Al Simpson and I would sit down with our committee and the House committee and would go through the difference between the House and the Senate bill. And then if it was all right with Simpson, we'd come back 2 weeks later and pass the bill and pass the conference. Because Simpson would say, well, if you're going to go to the conference, you're going to roll me and I'm not going to take it. So I'd say, well, we're going to treat you fairly. And he'd say, okay, if you're going to treat me fairly, we'll work it out before. And I'd say, okay, Al, let's go to work. And that's a way that you work and you build some confidence and you get a better product of it. And that's the kind of trust that you need to try and get things done in the Senate, and it's in short supply today.
Senator Ted Kennedy. His new book is America Back on Track. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Understanding the Crucial Link Between Mothers, Daughters, and Health, by Dr. Christiane Northrup. From Capella University, an accredited university online with degrees in business, IT, education, human services, and psychology, capella.edu. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, growing up as a Kennedy and looking after the children of his late brothers Jack and Robert. We continue our conversation with Senator Ted Kennedy. Also, Howl. The famous beat poem by Allen Ginsberg is 50 years old and the subject of a new collection of essays. Maureen Corrigan has a review. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're going back to our interview with Senator Ted Kennedy, who's written a new book on his policy priorities called America Back on Track. When we left off, Kennedy was explaining that when he first entered the Senate in 1962, it was a more collegial institution. I asked him when that changed and why.
First of all, the Senate is, you don't see, you're separated much more from the members because they're not spending as much time working in the committees. As I mentioned before, in the 60s and 70s, and I think still a part of the 80s, you were in there all week and also during the evening sessions. And a lot of people stayed around on the weekends because there was so much work to do, and people really developed relationships and friendships and willingness to try to work together. Now the power of money, the willingness and the need for people to go back to travel around the country to pick up money, and they're picking it up from particular groups. And those particular groups have very special interests in mind on particular pieces of legislation, and they are demanding for the members of Congress or how they're going to view a particular issue, and they are very clear about what they're expecting from their members of Congress on it, and that is more makes it more divisive as well. I mean, a big chunk of all of our problem is the money aspect of it. It's the I find even after having been in the Senate for the length of our time, we've developed a lot of contacts and a lot of friends and good supporters. I spend still a great deal of time having to raise the funds. I'm glad to do what's necessary to have to do it, but it takes away from doing the kind of job that you ought to be doing, and that is being the member of the United States Congress or the Senate.
Well, I guess we should briefly address this issue of campaign finance reform because, you know, there was the reforms of the 70s and then more recently the McCain-Feingold measure, which, you know, it seems has really failed to keep big, soft money out of elections. Why is that, and where do we go from here?
Well, as I say, I believe that what is necessary, what is called for, is the public financing of elections. You know, the best estimate now is that the lobbyists spend about $10 billion a year to influence legislation, about $10 billion a year. That is vastly more than what would be necessary if you had the public financing of House elections, Senate elections, and presidential elections. The principal reason that people don't want, you could do it for example, I think, believe that when the legislation that I introduced in the 1970s, which was after the Watergate, I think was 8 or 10 cents a primary vote or 12 cents in terms of a general election vote. I mean, in Massachusetts, it's somewhere around $4 or $5 million to run in a state. And that's really probably plenty. I mean, that gives you 4 or 5 weeks of television and enough to have a pretty good ground organization. Doesn't give you, you know, 15 or 24 weeks of television, but it gives you enough so that you're able to get across. Now, what happens is members of the Senate say, why in the world do I want to fund an opposition, and members of Congress, every 2 years? And they're going to get a chunk of change to run against me every 2 years. Why in the world do I want that? And why does a senator want to have a decently funded opponent every 6 years to run against me? Why do I want to have that? And somebody who was president would have a well-funded candidate that would run against him in 4 years. So they would rather not have that kind of. Most of them would rather have the existing system where they have to go on out, because they can raise a good deal more as incumbents than the challenger. The question is, what serves the country best? And the country would better be served by having well-funded challenges that would challenge members of the House and members of the Senate and the president. That would serve them best. And it would also save them the billions of dollars that would have as a result of the lobbying, and it would save the billions, I think, of dollars in terms of the kind of tax loopholes that get written in by the lobbyists into the tax bills every year that are special interests, which these lobbyists work on. Now, those are the realities. But at this present time, people say, look, I don't want my tax money used into politics. They just don't want it. But at the end of the day, they're getting it because they're paying for it with these lobbying activities, and it's something that, as I have said, too often we're getting the best Congress that money can buy, and I think it's a real disgrace.
We're speaking with Senator Ted Kennedy. He's just written a new book, America Back on Track. As a newspaper reporter covering elections for the Senate, Congress, and state and local elections for many, many years, I mean, I see a distinct difference in recent years now where if I'm covering a race of any stature, I will get daily email blasts and press releases from these political consultants, which are just overflowing with venom and distortion. I mean, to the point where they're almost self-discrediting. I mean, there is clearly a new viciousness in the way elections are conducted. And I have to think it's in part because these political consultants have learned that attacks win. How do we break the cycle? And let me just say, in my experience, I don't see much difference between the Democrats and the Republicans on this issue of their willingness to attack and really hit hard. How do we break that cycle?
Well, it's difficult, you know. Trying to think back when this all started, I think to a great extent it started when commercials began to go that way. I can remember a number of years ago when you had a Tylenol commercial. You know, Tylenol was great. Tylenol was good. Tylenol was the best. And then suddenly you got an ad that would be for Excedrin. And Excedrin would say, Tylenol is not that good. Excedrin is this much better. And suddenly, in the commercials, you got the naming the competitor and downgrading the competitor in the whole range of commercials. And I can remember just watching this sort of grow in the commercial areas, with regard to aspirin, Excedrin, and all the other kinds of things.
All and it must be because it works.
The bubbles, right. And it was because it worked. And I think the politics jumped right into this thing and said, this is working over in the commercial. It's got to work in the politics as well. I think it'll be good for somebody who wants to do an interesting political paper on all of that. I think it'll be worthwhile to find out whether this really followed the what happened in commercial advertising. My own sense is it did. I still think that... I remember Claiborne Pell, who's not well now, but one of the great senators, Rhode Island. He never had a negative campaign slogan about any of his opponent. And one of the things that Claiborne, and he always won and won easily, although he had a battle one time and he was running against a very talented woman in Rhode Island, and they ran... finished up a debate. They're just finishing up a debate, and they asked Claiborne, and they said, you've been in the Senate for some period of time. Can you name a single thing that you're proudest of? And he's thought about it and thought about it, and boom, the time ran out, and every one of the Pell supporters thought, well, that is the end of Claiborne Pell for the United States Senate. And he went up 10 points. And that is because everybody in Rhode Island was so tired of listening to politicians telling about all the things that they did that they didn't do.
There was a human
being all knew,
there, right?
They all knew that Claiborne Pell had done the Pell Grants in education. He had the seabed treaties. He had the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts. I mean, he had done so much. He had done the rapid corridor train, the whole Acela concept from Boston down to Washington was Claiborne Pell's. But people understood that he had been doing, but they were just tired of politicians just blowing their own horns. So, you know, people, are, as we all know, are so much wiser or smarter than the consultants or the politicians that, paying attention to and respecting their views and respecting their integrity and their awareness and their understanding and their intelligence is something that they appreciate.
We're speaking with Senator Ted Kennedy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Senator Ted Kennedy. He's just written a new book. It's called America Back on Track. You know, Senator, growing up as a Kennedy, you were, of course, part of one of America's most prominent political families. And you write in your book about how you learned from your family values of public service. I mean, you know, your brother Joe having served and died in World War II. And I wonder, at what age did you become aware that, as a Kennedy, great things might be expected of you?
Well, I was enormously lucky as a young person. I mean, I had a terrific grandparents that were forces in my life that spoke to me about bigotry and discrimination against the Irish and about the whole immigrant past. Parents, mother and father that were inspirational in terms of my spiritual upbringing. Had a very strong faith, and which has been very important to me, and also a love of history and an interest in political life and books and learning and people. And then I had brothers who really taught me about the importance of service. I mean, I had, and then I was very lucky because I saw the system work. I mean, I saw politics work. I saw the person go out and get elected to Congress. I mean, that was a big deal. I mean, the idea that you had a brother that was a congressman was just, I thought, was the biggest deal that could possibly ever happen to any family. And then
You were 14 when Jack was elected to Congress,
when
right?
he was elected. Right. And then, my God, he beats Cabot Lodge in 1952, and this is just unheard of. And Cabot Lodge was a big deal, and Republican my brother had done, ran a good campaign. And then in the 60 campaign, to see that move and go. So I had seen, and I still believe in the political institutions functioning and working because I've seen it done. And I believe in this whole process because I've seen it work.
You know, Senator, as I hear you describe, you know, seeing your brother go to Congress when you were at 14, I mean, when I was 14, when most people are at 14, they're utterly absorbed in themselves and their friends and their, you know, their ball games or whatever is going on at school. And here you are, you know, in a climate where, as you said, people are really part of a much wider world. Did it make you a more serious kid? Did it make you think, I need to think about how I'm going to be involved in that? Did you feel pressure?
Not really. It was really the power of example. I mean, I remember my brother when he first got elected to Congress, bringing me down to Washington and taking me by myself around to the buildings, bringing me into the House floor, bringing me over to show me the Senate, and then the Supreme Court, Library of Congress, and then giving me this little talk, which I still use for children that come from Massachusetts that I visit with, that say a trip like this is valuable because you see the buildings, but to make it really valuable, take an interest for the rest of your life of what goes on inside the buildings. That was always sort of a throwaway line that he had for me, but it always stuck with me. Uh-huh. And I could always remember when I'd come down from high school, I'd go down and visit him. And you know, I'd come in for breakfast, and I'd hear them talking about interesting things. And or at dinner time, you'd hear them talking about interesting things. And it was really the power of example. Really, it's the power of, no one was saying, well, you ought to do this, or ought to do that. It just seemed that the things that they were involved in, my brothers, I must say, my sisters as well. Eunice with the Special Olympics, 144 different countries. My sister Jean, the very special arts programs. Those that have some physical disabilities are still able to create and do incredible kinds of things. My sister Pat is very involved in a lot of the literature programs in New York City. They all were very much involved, and they were all doing interesting and involved undertakings that were involving people and events, and politics certainly became my interest. And running for office, I was sort of thinking about that back in college. It sort of had an appeal to me, and I took it from there.
And if you could indulge one more question about your family. You know, I know that besides being a father to your own children, you've had a very special, important role in the lives of the children of your brothers, President Kennedy and your brother, Senator Robert Kennedy, after their deaths. And, I mean, that's been described by some as that of a surrogate father. Clearly, you've been very involved in all those kids' lives while maintaining an incredibly active and professional public life of your own. And I'm wondering, I mean, I'm a father of two, and we took in another kid for a couple of years when her family was in trouble. And I have a sense of that level of responsibility. This seems to have been an enormously full, I suppose, joy and burden to carry for a long time while you were balancing this public life. And I'm just wondering if there are any insights or perspective you could share about how you have managed those competing priorities over these years.
Well, this was sort of something sort of obviously unexpected thrust on my sisters and myself, the really extraordinary, wonderful opportunity to try and make a difference in people's lives that were missing their fathers. And it's, I think, as people find out, the time and the effort and the energy that one puts in is repaid 1,000 times, and and what you get back. And children go through the various phases of growing up, and it's always a challenge these days. But I'm enormously proud of all of them and the things that they're doing and the involvement that they're in, and they're in a wide variety of different kinds of undertakings. I mean, whether it's documentaries or environmental movements or a wide range of different Save the Children, a great many of different types of activities. I'm very, very proud of them. One of the things we had recently, my parents always used to take us on a history trip, and my brother, when he was president, took us, and I made some with my brother Bob, and we just had our last history trip, which is 2 weeks ago, down to Harper's Ferry. We all go to the history museum the night before, and we listen about our lessons of history, what we're going to hear about John Brown, and then we pile in a bus and go down to Harper's Ferry and listen to the excellent presentations that are made by the Park Service down there, and then we've done a number of camping trips up our way around Massachusetts. Of course, it's just filled with the history, and which my parents took all of us when we were small. So we have a lot of fun on those these trips, and it's
perhaps
and they keep enjoying it. So I'm not as good a camper as I used to be. I'm beginning to yield that special pleasure to some of the younger ones.
I wonder if those are memories that some future senator is going to share about their childhood. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us, Senator Kennedy.
Fine. Listen, I appreciate it very much. It's good to talk with you. Really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Senator Ted Kennedy. His new book is America Back on Track. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan on a collection of essays commemorating Allen Ginsberg's famous poem, Howl. This is Fresh Air. To commemorate the 50th anniversary of the publication of Allen Ginsberg's most famous poem, Howl, editor Jason Schindler has assembled a new collection of essays called The Poem That Changed America. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review. Here's Ginsberg reading the opening of Howl, recorded in 1959.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix.
I've seen the best minds of a later generation zone out as soon as Ginsberg begins intoning those immortal opening lines. Okay, they aren't always the best minds, but they are college students. And the first few years I taught Howl, my students' Pavlovian response to what undeniably sounds like a big poetic pronouncement was to flip open their notebooks, pick up a pen, and glaze over. To combat this robotic reaction to a poem that indicts robotic behavior, I began to invite my students to leave their books and desks behind, sit on the classroom floor, and just listen to the recording of Ginsberg reading. That's worked better. The students sometimes start snapping their fingers and muttering beatnik phrases like, "Cool man," but at least they're not taking notes for the inevitable exam. Howl is a tough poem to teach. Students these days treat it either with solemnity or silliness. Admittedly, there are stretches of Howl that are just plain dull, to quote the verdict of Lionel Trilling, one of the poem's original detractors. The lines that are most decidedly not dull, all those sexual references that were the focus of the poem's 1957 obscenity trial, now elicit sniggers rather than shock. And yet, amidst all of what the poem itself calls stanzas of gibberish, there are images and cadences in Howl that still seem so buoyant they fly off the page, and a susceptible reader just can't help but try to flag down one of Ginsberg's drunken taxicabs of absolute reality and chase after them. For 50 years, Howl has packed a charge larger than the sum of all its messy, sometimes mediocre, sometimes wondrous parts. To commemorate the cultural phenomenon of Howl, Jason Schindler, who was a friend and assistant to Ginsberg, has gathered together essays by a lot of mostly smart writers reflecting on their early encounters with the poem. The collection, called The Poem That Changed America, is as all over the map as Howl itself. The act of ruminating on Howl seems to have inspired some of these writers to embrace that most idiotic of beat writing pronouncements, first thought, best thought. And so we have this spontaneous effusion from Rick Moody. Because of FCC regulations, every time I get to a certain word that rhymes with duck, I'll just say bleep. What I hated about poetry, Moody recalls, was Robert Frost. Bleep Robert Frost. Bleep stopping in woods on a snowy evening. I hated Robert Frost. Bleep nature imagery. Bleep meter. Bleep? I never thought about Frost that way. Other bebop rants on Howl spew off of Amiri Baraka and Andre Codrescu, who oh so archly credits the poem with propelling him out of Transylvania onto our shores, where he could howl himself. Go back to the castle, Count. But for every writer in this collection who consciously or not tries to out Ginsberg Ginsberg, there are two or three thoughtful writers who speak genuinely to the uneven greatness of the poem. Sven Burkert confesses that Howl caused him to glamorize psychosis when he first read it, but he also celebrates what he eloquently calls its sense of enunciatory risk. In a short, charged piece, Marge Piercy recalls hearing Ginsberg read Howl for the first time. She was a secretary trying to write poetry, and as she says, he reopened the world to me. And in one of the sharpest essays in the collection, David Gates talks about how something's been lost by our welcoming Howl into the canon, the possibility of another Howl. Every writer here who knew Ginsberg personally talks about what a kind man, what a mensch he was. I have proof of that hanging above my desk. I once had a student, one of the golden ones, who didn't take notes or snigger when he listened to Howl. This student was so blown away by the poem that he went off to hear Ginsberg read when he came to town, and he told Ginsberg about studying Howl in my class. Ginsberg responded by drawing a picture for me on a piece of scrap paper, a picture of a frowning Buddha, because, as he told my student, teaching is hard. especially hard when it comes to teaching the elusive, irritating, magical howl. But as so many of these essays also attest, still worth trying to do.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the memoir, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She reviewed the poem that changed America, Howl at 50, edited by Jason Schender. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From the Roth Family Foundation for the NPR Endowment, helping to fund NPR's West Coast Production Center. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor and comic John Leguizamo. He has a recurring role on ER and is the voice of Sid in the animated film Ice Age. Also an appreciation of Thelonious Monk by our jazz critic, and we hear from musicians who performed with or were influenced by the great jazz pianist and composer. Join us for the next Fresh Air.